She is ruthless. And in terms of her being like a feminist hero or feminist sleaze, that's a really curious discussion point, because to what extent do you cheer for her? To what extent do you, because she's not always very nice, but she acknowledges constantly that if you're nice, you're not going to get anywhere. You got to be tough here. And one of her favorite quotes, Maxine's, is from actually Bette Davis, where Bette Davis once said, "Until you're known in my profession as a monster, you're not a star."
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Deadpool and Wolverine, and also Maxine, and we're going to start off with Deadpool and Wolverine. And Mike, I will start off by saying, you know, we've talked so much about Marvel fatigue. You know, like, how many more movies are they going to try to roll out? How many more iterations are they going to make of each individual character? But having said that, I loved this movie. I thought this movie was so much fun to watch. I had a few problems with the amount of gore, but in terms of the repartee, I thought this movie was hilarious. Where do you want to begin with it?
Well, something less than love, I'll say. For starters, with Deadpool and Wolverine, it's the third film in this particular franchise. And it's very much a movie that knows it's a movie. From the opening narration, it's breaking that fourth wall. For instance, with the inside jokes that aren't so inside, actually, you know, one of the first things said in the movie is, you know, Disney's so stupid. So it makes fun of Disney, which is the releasing studio. It makes fun of Fox, which was swallowed up by Disney. So, you know, in Los Angeles, people were probably falling in the aisles with laughter because this is like, you know, trade jokes. But enough of the public gets that, too. But here's where, for me, there's a fatigue factor. Namely, that I can appreciate that sort of self-reflexive, jokey quality, but honestly, it wears thin for me. So even though I did laugh at a lot of those throughout the film, but after the first 10 or 15 minutes, I felt like it was enough already with the self-referentiality, and it just got to be kind of cloying for my taste. The second thing that became a bit much for me actually is the gore that Marie mentioned. It's just really, even by today's standards, it's excessive. At times, and I know I sound puritanical when I say that, but I'll be puritanical then. It's just like, you don't need it to that degree. Come on. And it's all meant as comedy, of course, but to what extent are you laughing after a while at all that gore? So that's the second reservation. The third is kind of a curious industry note. Namely, this is, you know, it's such a huge box office hit and it's rated R. And of course, superhero movies are almost never rated R. So this one sets itself apart that way. Within the Marvel Universe, that, you know, it wants everyone to go so long as they have a parental supervisor with them. The thing is, though, it goes to that R rating with a vengeance. Number one, the gore that we've already talked about. Number two, the language. This film is rife. I love using the word rife. This film is rife with America's favorite four-letter word. And I saw it in a theater where, like, every time that word was said, people were laughing. It's sort of Pavlovian, right? That people laugh at that word. But for me, it's like, you know, it wasn't that I was offended. It's far worse than that. I was bored. And it's like, after a while, it's like, you know, it's not particularly clever. It's not funny. It's like so knee-jerk, automatic, like, okay, well, you know, in the next line of dialogue, you know, this and this and this and, you know, all the F-bombs and so on. And it's really not that clever at that level. It's just simply, you know, if I say obscene, I don't want to sound again like the state censor board, but you know, it really is at that point just like tossing it in like, well, this will get another laugh. And I got to admit, it does get a lot of laughs from people, but I find myself that I'm just not laughing as much. So those are at least three reasons why I can appreciate how much people have appreciated the film and enjoyed it and laughed at it, because I did too. But for a film that runs a little over 2 hours, which is not excessive, it's 127 minutes, not excessive by superhero standards, it still for me started to flag easily 15 to 20 minutes into it. And then it was just making note of, you know, all of the vulgarities, all the gore and so on. And really not as clever, perhaps, as it thought it is. That's why ultimately I felt kind of let down by it and really sort of deflated by it. But on all those depressing and negative notes, let me turn it back to you.
Well, I sort of expected all the F-bombs and I expected it to be violent. So I was braced for it, I guess. I did want to mention it's a superhero movie, and yet it's got a lot of profanity in it. It's meant for an audience of 17 years and older. But Ryan Reynolds admitted that he showed the movie to his 9-year-old daughter and his 70-year-old mother, and that they both loved it. So it's sad to say, actually, that people aren't prepared for this kind of thing, especially from these characters. I also wanted to mention, though, just in terms of the dialogue and everything, that no one was allowed to improvise dialogue because there was that strike going on with the Writers Guild. So everything you heard wasn't ad-libbed. It was actually scripted that way. So that's actually a criticism, I think, for the script writer, not necessarily the actors.
Well, a quick footnote on that. Occasionally I'll read scripts or portions of scripts, and it can be rather dispiriting because when you read the script for a film like this, it's like if it's funny on the screen, a lot has to do with performance, right? And context. But when you simply read it as a script, it has a vocabulary of about 10 words, and I'm insulting you with some F-bombs, and you throw some back. And it's like, oh, how many pages of this can we take? But on your earlier point, in terms of audiences somehow not expecting or not, I think the opposite, actually. I think this movie is boasting about its R rating. People who go to see it, that's why they're going among. In other words, they want a superhero movie that's naughtier than most. They want to push that envelope. And so in the making and in the marketing of it, I think audiences are keenly aware of that. Now, what I find interesting is your observation about the family. It's flipped to say that, well, Ryan Reynolds must have a dysfunctional family. And so I'm not saying that. I'm just simply saying that, I think it's a curious question, and joking aside, for parents with smaller children. Do you want to take your kids to see this? Between the language and the violence, only parents can answer that for themselves, right? It would be ridiculous for me to be draconian with a judgment there. But if you have smaller kids, I would think once kids get into their teens, and certainly by mid-teens, there's not a word here they haven't heard and used before, right? And they see a lot of violence in all their video games and movies and et cetera, VR headsets. They know violence. So that's again a judgment call, but that's where you're creeping closer to the 17. And I think actually that's the audience that most appreciates it, actually, would be like mid to late teens and so on, because that's where you sort of enjoy using language like that, because your parents don't want you to say that word, and so you say it anyway. But again, joking aside on this, I think that is a serious question for parents with kids as to, do you take them with you? Because in many ways, a lot of this is just silly, goofy stuff, right? I mean, it's congruent with a lot of the superhero, trading barbs back and forth. It's just, let's just say, saltier than usual.
Well, I actually thought when I was watching it that it was improvised dialogue because so much of it sounded like that sort of zany character that Ryan Reynolds plays in a little bit in all of his movies. And I have to tell you, every time he said baby knife, I cracked up. There's just something about his deadpan delivery and his sense of humor that just I found just really, really funny. So I'm surprised that it was all actually scripted and that they were just following the script. I think the chemistry between Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman was great. And I think, I'm not a big comic book person, but even I know that Deadpool and Wolverine are kind of the edgier of the superheroes. So, you're sort of expecting to get, that bad boy aspect, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and actually, when you think of these actors, they're veterans of this kind of comedy. And you make a good point with Ryan Reynolds. He makes it seem improvised because he seems like a stand-up comic who's on a riff. And when a stand-up comic and you're riffing with a live audience, you're not quite sure where it's going to land either, right? You just keep going. And he has that quality, and there's a charismatic quality there, which, even though I wasn't enjoying the film, I was actually enjoying the performance as a performance, which is a distinction of sorts. But the fact that they're veterans here, Ryan Reynolds is 47, Hugh Jackman's 55. They've been in their share of superhero movies. They know the drills, they know the outfits, if you will. And so they can trade things back and forth that way. And in terms of what you do at this point in a franchise, is history. Again, this is the third Deadpool. There's a reminder, there are many reminders in the film, actually, that wasn't Wolverine killed in 2017, in the earlier movie. And so that I did laugh at, because so often in a superhero movie, you think, well, that's it for him. He's a goner. I was at the funeral. He's a goner. But then you always have an excuse, because after all, you're dealing with supernatural stuff, with magic. So you always have ways to somehow bring a character back. Now, on the one hand, I think that's funny. I mean, it is like you can't keep a good monster down kind of, or superhero down kind of thing. It always bounces back, right? But on the other hand, not that you take a movie like this seriously, but on the other hand, it just seems like, well, nothing really matters then, because it's just like, if somebody gets knocked off, whatever, well, a year later, there's the next installment. Guess what? He was in some alternate universe and now he's back. And my response is another one of America's favorite words, whatever. Those are occasions where you actually use the word whatever. Well, whatever. There he is, he's back. And the movie does have some fun with that, like at the graveside and this and that. But somehow, there'll be Wolverine or a Wolverine coming back, and you got to smile at some of that because it's so shameless, right? It's just right up front with it.
They also give you multiple Deadpools, which reminded me of that was the thing I liked about the Into the Spider-Verse movies, that there were other Spider-Men. So I found that to be a kind of a fun thing. The dog pool. That's the strangest looking dog I've ever seen. And actually, it's Ryan Reynolds' kids playing Kid Pool and Baby Pool. So I kind of liked all the mini Deadpools, extra Deadpools. Did you like that part or not?
Well, again, I mean, I smiled at a lot of that because when you're all in for a self-reflexive a movie like that, it never quits, right? It just keeps going. So you have, that what amounts to like stunt casting, whether of characters or the actors. And at that level, it is kind of fun to do the additional research as in, hey, who's that kid? Kind of stuff, because it just never ends. It just keeps going. It's a hall of mirrors in a lot of ways. I could appreciate that. I could smile at some of that. Maybe my smile was not quite as broad as yours, but I was smiling at some of that. Sure, I can. I'm not totally a grouch with it. Sure.
I also enjoyed including the song Bye 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 because in Deadpool 2, they use a Celine Dion song, Out of Ashes. And Deadpool tells Celine Dion that she has to shoot it again because she shot it at like an 11 and he needed her to come down to like a 5. And she says, "This thing only goes to 11. Beat it, Spider-Man." And then he says, "Man, I should have asked NSYNC." So, like little things like that, if you remember from the other movies, it's hilarious. A lot of those asides are just kind of tossed out there, but I thought they were just really funny. And
But
so
you know
did
what?
the audience. My
Oh,
audience,
yeah.
which was not late teenagers, it was a lot of like seasoned middle-agers, let's say that.
Well, thank you for using that word because when you mentioned the musical selections, it's something I also noticed too, that this is a movie that got a very much an adult audience, people who were going for an R movie. And after all, we've had these superhero movies for so long now, you could be a young adult who's now a middle-aged adult, right? I mean, people edge into it and become lifelong fanboys, if you will, fanboys with a bit of a pot belly. These are fanboys who've been around a while. But no, but your reference to the music, the fact that when you mention particular acts like that, this is music that a middle-aged person could appreciate and know more than a teenager, actually. And so in that sense, it's sort of a musical soundtrack that, as I mentioned earlier with the actors, you have two middle-aged actors. This is the music they would listen to and know. And so the movie is actually pitching itself in that respect. Not that a younger person can't appreciate that music, but directly pitching itself at a middle-aged audience.
And also, let's acknowledge the fact that Hugh Jackman really got into shape fast because he's been on Broadway, I think, doing The Music Man. Not a role where you need to be super buff, but in order to get in shape for this, it sort of reminds me of a discussion we had about Daniel Craig and James Bond, where he said, at some point, you just can't do it anymore. Your body just it just takes so much to get into that level of fitness. Hugh Jackman looks amazing. So you're right. If it's pitching at all to a more seasoned audience, it gives you some amazing somebody's personal trainer needs a raise.
Oh, I know. It's actually very funny in the film because it's one of those movies like, well, any excuse to take off your shirt, and
Yes.
it's one of those things. Not that anyone in the audience is complaining, but you look and you think there's buff and there's buff. There's not an ounce of fat. It's just, I mean, it's all him, I realize, but you keep thinking, is this computer generated? What produced such a body? And again, I think that's actually to the film's credit is that it knows what the audience wants, number one, and number two, it knows how to deliver that in a really lighthearted way. And it is funny with that, actually. And when I read the end credits, you're looking for personal trainer, right? You want to find out who this person is.
Well, there are certainly a lot of credits, and I want to mention, and I know everybody knows this when it's a Marvel movie, you have to wait till the bitter end for that last scene. But I will, I have to give it to them for restraint because it only goes 7 minutes over the 2 hour mark, which is admirable in most of these superhero movies.
Yeah, it's ironic that we discussed that point because you would think, okay, it's over 2 hours long, but so many of these superhero movies are 2.5, pushing 3 hours. So 127 minutes seems brief. It's breezy. And actually, to the film's credit, it does kick along at a nice pace. You know what I mean? It doesn't really dawdle for too long. And even though I was bored by the film, I had to acknowledge that the pacing was pretty fleet, pretty quick most of the way through. And so yeah, the end credits are going to be long for any superhero movie, and but you got to stick it out to the bitter end. You want those 20 seconds of footage at the very end of the film. And so it is interesting. Audiences usually flee the theater as soon as the film is over, but it, now they're trained to stay in their seats for that. And you know, even when it's a film I'm not crazy about, of course I stay. I mean, I don't want to be the one kid who's, oh, you didn't see that? You know, I don't want to have that on my conscience. Oh, I saw every minute of it.
Right. You want to make sure you see all of it. So, last point I wanted to ask you about is in terms of it being a buddy movie, the filmmakers cite Planes, Trains, and Automobiles from 1987, Midnight Run from 88, and 48 Hours from 1982. I can sort of see 48 Hours. I'm not sure about the other two.
Yeah, I heard a radio interview with Ryan Reynolds where he talked overtly about the movies you just mentioned, and he was a big fan of John Candy, for instance, as a comedian. And I can see aspects of that because these are what I'll call like shaggy dog tales. You know, whether it's a night in Manhattan or it's a road trip or whatever, and all kinds of stuff happens. So these are episodic films in that respect. And once you start on that road, quite literally, almost anything goes, right? You don't know what's around the next bend, and so I wouldn't push the comparisons too far, too literally, but in a generic sense, absolutely. I mean, you just see that kind of shaggy dog quality to it. And that's why, even when I'm not crazy about the film, I think, you know, it's not taking itself seriously, and I won't take it seriously. And, you know, you could do a lot worse for your entertainment dollar. So that's the case where, again, this is also part of that middle-aged aspect you and I talk about. If you're in the age range that they are as actors, particularly Ryan Reynolds from that quote, growing up, what did you see as a young adult? What influenced you? And so I found that kind of interesting, actually, that for him, these are comedy classics, you know, and I actually, you know, enjoy the films you've mentioned, and I can see how those would affect him as a filmmaker, as an actor.
Well, let's move on to Maxine because you have given me the perfect segue in that. All right, first of all, when I went to see it, I did not realize it was the third part of a trilogy and had no idea what was going on. So I went back and watched the other two movies, and now everything makes sense. So the first thing I would say to anybody wanting to see this, see the other two movies first, or you will be completely lost. But what one of the things that they get right out of the gate is that 1980s music. And the cars and the hair and the clothes. So on the money. I graduated from high school in the 80s, and this was just so perfectly set up. But this is not my genre of movie. I don't particularly enjoy horror. So, Mike, why don't you start off talking about the movie in terms of people who do appreciate that style of filmmaking and how you would describe the trilogy leading
Yeah,
up to Maxine?
sure, absolutely. The filmmaker Ty West is working in a genre or subgenre, if you will. It's been referred to as the horror verse. And so, in terms of the first two movies, it really does, I won't say it's essential, but as Marie said, and I'll underscore, it really helps if you've seen the first two. If this isn't your genre or subgenre, just steer clear of the whole package. But if you're interested, you know, there was X, which came out in 2022, and its immediate sequel the same year, Pearl. And because they really do follow this character, Maxine, she's a pornographic film star. There's a massacre, why not, in a horror movie. She's the only survivor. She's that lone woman who's, you know, that happens sometimes, right? Like everyone's been cut down right and left, but she's going to make it through. She's our protagonist. And to put it mildly, she's had a difficult life, one thing after another. You know, it ain't been easy for her. So what's interesting about it in terms of the perspective on Maxine and her name, actually, a lot of X's here, Maxine makes, she's a triple X in the title itself, is the fact that the film has been described as feminist sleaze. And this is where it's like we could spend hours talking about this because, yes, we're all for feminism, and she's certainly a torchbearer that way. She's going to make it through. And she has a quote, the character has a quote from her father that's like a mantra, you know, I will not accept a life I do not deserve. She's going to make it one way or another. And she's a tough character. And yet, in this industry she's working in, she's really in the you know, the sub-basement, if you will, in terms of porn and exploitation. To her credit, to Maxine's credit, she's trying to work her way out of that and get into mainstream movies. The year of this new film is 1985. And as Marie says, it's like letter perfect in terms of everything from cars to costumes to music. It really is nostalgic. I'm not sure I'm nostalgic for all the killing in a serial killer movie, but it does really, and actually, you know, again, joking aside here, it does actually acknowledge the extent to which such mass killings, serial killings, and all were taking place, you know, in the 70s, 80s, whatever. It sort of harkens back to that, if you will. And so this 1985 set film involves not just Maxine, who's played by Mia Goth, but a character known as the Night Stalker. And as you watch the film, and I won't spoil anything, you're wondering, well, how will these things intersect? Her quest to become a mainstream movie star, and this serial killer who's in residence in Southern California, what's going to happen here? What I did enjoy about the film, and I use the word enjoy, I guess, with air quotes around it, because it's a really tough film in a lot of ways. It's really grimy and gritty and all that, is that here's a coincidence and a curious one, that just as Deadpool's like the third installment, this is the third installment in another, I'll call it a franchise. And it's not a movie in the sense of breaking the fourth wall, but it's very much a movie. It has a lot of references. Number one, because of course the main character is a film actress. And number two, that it puts it all very much in context. For instance, she wants to become a star so desperately. So there's a scene where she's walking down the street, and it's actually the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And she puts out her cigarette. And of course, when you're an actress like that, you're going to stub it out with your foot decisively, right? You're going to stomp on it. And where she stomps on it is actually the star for Theda Bara, who was, you know, a screen star in the late 19-teens. She was what was known as a vamp. So the movie is actually setting us up for a kind of feminist take on this, that women, as they're presented in Hollywood movies, are presented most often through their sexuality, that they are the vamps. And you know, if not always the femme fatale, but certainly, you know, the vamp female. Then also in the film, a lot of time is spent on the back lot of Universal Studios. And so you get to see some of the old film sets, and you know, it's really a trip that way, because it's the actual locations that were used for a lot of these famous films. And of course, I enjoyed that. And then the third thing I enjoyed in that respect was the fact that she is ruthless. And in terms of her being like a feminist hero or feminist sleaze, that's a really curious discussion point, because to what extent do you cheer for her? To what extent do you, because she's not always very nice. But she acknowledges constantly that if you're nice, you're not going to get anywhere. You got to be tough here. And one of her favorite quotes, Maxine's, is from actually Betty Davis, where Betty Davis once said, "Until you're known in my profession as a monster, you're not a star." Mm-hmm. And so that's again where, you know, I'm watching with very mixed feelings, but there's a kind of ruthless quality to Maxine that you could say is warranted here, but she's not exactly going to be like an audience favorite necessarily. So Marie, let me throw this back to you, because clearly there's a feminist perspective on this, and yet it's not like all out cheerleading, I would say, for Maxine. What do you think?
Well, I love that idea of feminist sleaze. I hadn't heard that before. The thing that I noticed when watching the trilogy is the repetition of certain imagery. And so not in Maxine, but in another movie in the trilogy, it's this idea of, you know, I got to get off this farm. I have to, and the only way to do that is to become really famous and a star. And this desperation for that outcome is what drives the story, which is very interesting. And I'll also mention that Theda Bara shows up in the other movies as an alligator, which eats some of the people. So, you know, I mean, they definitely want to underscore that idea of that early sex symbol. But I also noticed some similarities to Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, you know, scarecrows and cornfields and remote areas with farmhouses, and kind of reminding me of the movie Badlands, and kind of that whole Andrew Wyeth thing, a little bit of Flannery O'Connor. And of course, Psycho. They do bring it in literally to, you know, use it as, which was fun, by the way. That was a really cool idea to use something that famous in a sort of updated contemporary way.
Oh, I love that completely. I mean, you know, this is a movie, even if this horror genre isn't your genre, if you're a movie buff, a movie mm-hmm. geek, just to have that scene, you know, with the Psycho house, I mean, it's just mind-boggling when you think that's the actual location, that's it. And so, of course, I enjoyed that immensely. So even though otherwise in the film, you know, I had very mixed feelings about it, it is a movie in a sense that you can enjoy there. And, you know, in some way quite realistic, I would say, in that, you know, if you want to get ahead, it's like that Betty Davis quote. I mean, you got to be like so assertive that you're kind of monstrous to other people. And yet, so she has to be that way. But then there is that Night Stalker who, you know, without spoiling anything, you know, you got a monster on the rampage there. And then you have all sorts of interesting, and this is almost like a film noirish bit of characterization, casting, All these secondary characters, homicide detectives and a private eye, and that, and they really get into the sleaze, speaking of which, right? And you gotta, like, sort of at a B movie level and enjoy that, that it's not just the actors who are wallowing in this grimy setting. Even the figures of Law and Order are themselves a little slimy, don't you think? I mean, it's not like our leading citizens. And so, like, nobody comes off looking very good here. Let's put it that way.
Well, it's that noir idea that you're, this is a story about the underworld, not something about John and Jane Q. Public. It's not going to be an everyman story. You're going to find out, what goes on in the underworld. That's part of the appeal. And, you kind of took the words right out of my mouth because I was going to ask you whether it's trying to pretend it's a B movie with the topics that they include, or is it actually a B movie? I can't make up my mind.
That's a great question because fundamentally, in terms of subject matter and treatment and outlook, I'd say yes, B movie material. And yet, it really is, I would say, an A movie in terms of budgeting and so on, trying to be or pass itself off as a B movie. And but it's sort of a kind of semantic conundrum there as to, well, what's the dividing line here? But it seems to me it's a big enough budget and enough, some star actors and enough smarts, if you will, that way in terms of what we expect from an A movie. And yet the subject matter is so B movie oriented. And the reason it's a really difficult question is so many of the big movies we have today would have been B movie material back in the day, right? When Spielberg's Jaws came out in 1975, people said this is a B movie with an A movie budget. And so I think we're in a world now where I think that the strict dividing line between A and B is, let's say, kind of softened or blurred. So I love the way you asked that question because I sort of wonder the same thing as I'm watching it.
Now, are you going to mention the axe in the door scene to any of your students who are watching Broken Blossoms?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to, should I be like endorsing and Maxine, like, this is what you got to go see. But if they should mention it to me, I'll make that reference. But it's a tough movie to recommend. I mean, joking aside, it's a tough movie to recommend in a lot of ways. You have to know that genre or at least be a movie geek in terms of wanting to see the Universal backlot. There are reasons to watch this. But again, in terms of this being the third one, like, how much more can happen to her? I hope she finally does become a big star and maybe can make a PG-rated movie at this point.
Actually, I see her more, becoming a producer and maybe changing it, but that wouldn't be a very interesting movie, not more attention than that. So, we'll call this arty horror because like I said, this is not my genre, but I didn't feel like it was just horror for the sake of horror. I did think it did a nice job of setting the stage using really good music, and some of the scenes were really beautifully shot.
Well, the horror is totally warranted in terms of what her life and then also this Night Stalker character, it's warranted but within the script. And it's not excessively gory. I mean, unlike Deadpool, where it's violent for the sake of being violent, here it's what I call warranted violence. Within the story, you're going to need some nasty business, right? And it doesn't wallow in that at all, really. It gets us just enough so that we realize how sleazy the whole environment is. And so I actually like that about the film is that there's some smart people behind this film. They know what they're doing. And that if they're working with B-level material, they know that material so well that there's sort of an A-level patina for it. When you mention scenes that are well shot, that's where, again, this is the filmmaking smarts that kick in.
Yeah, definitely a director to watch. It'll be interesting to see what he comes up with next. But that brings us to the end of this episode. Check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.